not messing around this morning. Go to John 15. Let's go. Come on. All right, real quick, this story. So I go to annual conference, which is our denominational institutional pastor's meeting this past week. Not life-giving. So we're having a worship service to kick the clergy meeting off, and we're singing four or five hymns, and you got to know that I don't mind hymns. I like hymns, and all is fine. And we're in the fifth hymn now, and it's just a little bit dirgy, a little bit organy, and we had just finished like the fifth verse, and they started the sixth. Have you ever said something out loud that you thought you said inside your head? So literally I said, "Dear God, how many verses are there?" Well, I had about six white-haired pastors turn and look at me like, heretic. So I thought, man, I got to get out of town. I'm going to be burned at the stake. All right, so John chapter 15, pick it up in verse 9. It's going to be the foundational verse for our teaching today. It says, Jesus says, "As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commands and remain in his love." Verse 11. "I have told you this so that my joy," not the world's joy, not your neighbor's joy, not your spouse's joy, Jesus says, my joy will be in you, and that your joy will then be completed. Right? Jesus says, my joy made perfect in you so that you can have this joy completed. This is where we're going to be today. I would make the argument that there's a direct correlation between our capacity to contain the love of Jesus as well as our ability to sustain that love through all circumstances and the joy that emanates from our life. Right? Our capacity to have this love, our ability to sustain it through all circumstances, is directly correlated to the joy that emanates from our life. I think the Apostle Paul was the master at this. This is the guy who was shipwrecked, flogged more times than we can count, was rejected by his own people, was actually stoned outside one city only to get up and go back in for more. He is the same guy who writes in Philippians 4. He says, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice." Right? I mean, you got to admit, this is way more than just eternal optimism, right? This is a guy who's like full of joy. In Acts chapter 16, it says that Paul and Silas were in jail. And that in of itself would be bad enough, but they had been flogged and beaten, imprisoned, and they knew the next day it was possible that it was going to be their last. But at midnight, Scripture says, Paul and Silas were found praying and singing to God. Can you imagine how irritating this must have been, this level of joy to his captors? Right? "We just beat you. You're behind bars. You're chained to a wall, and you're singing and praying." It's just got to be so irritating because you know personally, when you're angry and pissy and you just don't want to be over it yet, and somebody around you is like, you know, singing Kumbaya and picking daisies, you know how mad that makes you when you go, "I'm not ready to be unangry yet," right? Right? I have spouses say, "Listen, I love him, but I'm not done being angry at him," right? So, I mean, it's just, you know how irritating that is. Seriously. Who among us wouldn't want that kind of joy? The kind of joy that gets you singing at midnight behind bars with your back bleeding, with life hanging by a thread. Man, that's a joy. That's a joy worth having. In our entertainment-driven culture of instant gratification and constant amusement, it's hard to understand the suffering the apostles endured for the sake of the gospel. And they did it all with an attitude of joyful confidence. Most of us, if we're honest, will do anything to avoid trials and tribulations. We spend a great deal of time and endless amounts of money to avoid anything uncomfortable. But I think daily we're at a crossroads. We're tested daily to see whether we actually have the joy of Jesus in us or whether we're just feeling entitled to be happy. And I want us to be clear this morning. Happiness is not a goal. It's a momentary byproduct of getting our wants and desires met. And no one gets 100% of their wants and desires met ever in life, in this world. And thus, the chasm of despair is created between these sporadic experiences that ebbs and flows, highs and lows in our life. Most of the people who come into my office tell me that they're just not happy. Interestingly enough, they can trace their unhappiness back to some unmet want or desire in their life. Joy, on the other hand, is this effervescent love of God oozing out of us that does not yield to outside influences. While happiness is situational and circumstantial, it comes and goes. It's very different than joy. Think about how often we use the word love. This is the connection. We use the word love and we throw it around just kind of without much thought because, you know, we can love food and then we say we love our spouse as if that's the same thing. You know, we can love Jesus and then, you know, love the Gators. It's not the same thing. I mean, it's just we confuse this kind of stuff all the time. And then we get in the car and then culture reinforces all these concepts of love. There's songs about love, selfish and self-centered love, one-sided hopeless love, deceit and cruelty masquerading as love, but rarely pure, other-centered, sacrificial love that will persevere. And it's not surprising to me that we're so messed up about love that we can't get the joy thing right because we can't get the love thing right. I mean, we've so convoluted and messed up the concept of love. Joy is just like foreign to us, right? We just can't get it right. If you ask people what they want in life, they will tell you pretty clearly what they want and what they want for their kids is, I just want to be happy. I hear Dee Dee say all the time that a mom is only as happy as her unhappiest child, right? I think that's right. Moms, right? You're only as happy as your unhappiest child, right? Which is why I tell couples, never have children. So it's, you know, it just is easier. I say just, you know, it looks really cool. Get a puppy. It's like, that's what I tell them. So, I mean, I know people who are gripped by fear that they might not ever be happy. And living this way, if you live this way, your spirit animal becomes Eeyore. I mean, he's like, you know, I mean, it's like, you're like in a perpetual posture of pessimism. Listen, I get it. Everyone would rather be happy than miserable. If given the choice, we would choose gladness over sadness. We would choose winning over losing. The truth is depending on how the Gators do in any sport has a direct influence over my immediate mood the rest of the day and quite possibly carried into the next day. There are some Saturdays I lay in bed and I replay every play, every shot, every swing, men's, women's sports, lacrosse team loses, I don't sleep for a night. I mean, it's crazy. How is it that the performance of 18 and 19-year-old young men and women can have such a dramatic hold on my emotions? And just for the record, it was not lost on me last week that one of our communion servers at 11 o'clock wore a bright, bold Boston Red Sox shirt the day after they beat my Astros. That was not lost on me. I am slow, but I ain't stupid, right? And I am in charge, and we've had him removed from the communion staff. So it's just like, he's out of there, right? Right? The fact is that we would choose sun over rain. We'd rather attend a wedding than a funeral. We'd rather ride the crest of the wave of vocational success than struggle in the trenches of teachable moments. If given the option, we'd rather sing, dance, and shout than moan, weep, and wail. The truth is, church, we are happiness junkies. We're happiness junkies, and we get a fix, and as soon as we get a fix, we're looking for the next fix. We have this happiness-seeking, happiness-hunting nature in all of us. And I believe we choose our spouses and our friends and our careers and even our churches based on this happiness factor, which explains why you can be happy one moment and then 6 months later be completely unhappy and unsure why you're where you're at. Because happiness is unsustainable. It's a colander that leaks all the goodness out of it. I think that we live in a culture that believes that we have happiness coming. We feel like we're owed happiness. After all, in America, we have been promised happiness and the pursuit of happiness as an inalienable right. You have been told this is a right you have. The problem is happiness is fleeting because we live in a broken world that is unrelenting in its desire to have misery find company. In John 10:10, it says the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I think even the most novice churchgoer knows the enemy's desire is to destroy our life. But what is it that he wants to steal? I would say that what he wants to steal is your peace and your joy. Because if he can steal your peace and your joy, then he can steal your Jesus. It's why Jesus follows that line with this reality. He says, I have come so that you may have life and have it to the full. What some translations say, have it abundantly, even in the midst of your problems. Life in Jesus can't be stolen. The light of Jesus can't be snuffed out. His joy, his peace can never be robbed from us. His life is not a fleeting emotion or a temporary patch. His life is a permanent manifestation of the fruit of the Spirit. The reality is that even the most prominent amongst us. Even a Fortune 500 CEO who's married to Miss Universe, driving a Lamborghini, living in an oceanfront estate, is going to have some problems. In fact, we might argue that guy has more problems than anybody else. That's a lot of people to keep happy in his life. In fact, his stuff might present more problems because very soon, if you have a lot of stuff, your possessions begin to possess you, the Bible says. Jesus even said, in this world, you will have trouble. And trouble does not discriminate. You can't get around it. You can't eliminate it. You can't self-medicate your troubles away. Because you get up the next morning, they're still there. Now they're there with a hangover. In an effort to chase our troubles away and get our happiness back, we adopt what I call an exchange philosophy, a barter system, if you will. And we'll trade our spouses, we'll trade our cars, we'll change jobs, and we will even change where we live. We'll move to a different geographical location. We buy bigger houses and more toys, but in the end, we discover we're on this never-ending merry-go-round of dissatisfaction that follows behind us everywhere we go. And now it's just littered with collateral damage and hurt people for bad exchanges. I've seen people so obsessed with their looks who have been connected, their looks connected to their beauty and their happiness, that they tan and train and lift and laser and liposuck and Botox their way through life, as if you can cheat Father Time forever. I've personally learned just being fluffy reduces, do I have wrinkles? Look at this face. Listen, I just tell people being a little bit fluffy eliminates wrinkles, right? It's a lot cheaper, right? Listen, eventually, mirror on the wall will tell us we're no longer the fairest of them all. Our bodies are decaying from the moment we arrive, and no one cheats aging. You just might look better in your casket than your neighbor. That's the only thing that might happen. And the truth is you can do this with any aspect of life. You take any aspect of life. You take work, you take hobbies, you take your friends, you take even church. I'm telling you this morning, we are happiness junkies. Listen, I think it's natural for people to struggle with happiness in the face of disappointment and loss. And I would never try to talk anyone out of their season of grief or minimize their pain or even try to pretend that you can talk or walk your way through a serious mental health struggle. I would never do that. But I meet so many people who think they're struggling, and all the while they enjoy the blessings of a great family, loving friends, good homes, good jobs, all the things that are supposed to add up to a good life, but somehow fails to meet the bar of happiness for them. Happiness is so elusive for them that they can't seem to nail down satisfaction. And the hard part is no one wants to admit that this is not a happiness issue. It's a spiritual issue. It's a spiritual issue. This malaise that affects so many is more than just an absence of happiness. I believe it's an absence of Jesus. The absence of joy that comes from a deep, fulfilling relationship with God. The kind of joy that comes when Jesus imparts a permanent inner heart change of mind and soul. Listen, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy, but it's an entirely different deal, an indescribable experience to know the joy that comes from the love of Jesus. It's Paul that writes in Romans, what can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? Again, I think there's a direct correlation between this kind of troubleshooting love and what I call defiant joy. If there was one country on earth where people should be happy, it should be the United States of America. We are by far one of the wealthiest nations in the world, with more stuff than you can shake a stick at. Nobody in the world has grocery stores like we have grocery stores, right? And yet we're still among the world leaders in depression, suicide rates, and addictions. Suicide rates in 2018 are up 33%, right? Suicide kills more people in the last few years than car accidents in this country. We are a people that keep looking for love and affirmation in all the wrong places, and when we don't find it, we make permanent decisions about temporary problems. What perplexes the medical community is that we have so many more reasons to be joyful than the rest of the world, and yet our freedom has led to an entitlement that has created people who are distraught. We have propped up a belief system that others exist to make us happy, and the system is precariously fragile. And you just can't get your happiness from somebody else. It just doesn't work that way. Theologian J.P. Moreland argues that We are terribly confused about what happiness is, and as a result, we find that it never lasts. Americans have a sense of happiness entitlement that negates responsibility for living any kind of life that would promote it. It's what some have called the strange melancholy in the midst of so much abundance. Strange melancholy in the midst of so much abundance. We are surrounded by people who never think they have enough. They're always looking for more. If we're single, we want to be married. If we're married, we want a better spouse. No matter what we look like, we want to be thinner, prettier, richer. Can I tell you how infuriating it is for me, for one of you people that are about that big around, to tell me that you'd like to lose 2 pounds? All right? 2 pounds. Really? Really? I could lose 20 pounds and nobody would know. It drives me. If I could just lose 2 pounds, right? Here, come here, I'll punch you. I'll lose 2 pounds on you. I'll take 2 pounds right off of you, right? It's I'm just not happy. Listen, man, we're just never satisfied. We want a good job, then we want a better job. Then we raise our children that aren't grateful for what they have because we haven't stopped long enough to be grateful for what we have. It's a perpetuating cycle of narcissism that leads to cynicism that makes the abundant life Teflon to joy. It just slides right off. Happiness is about what happens to you and to some extent is dependent on the ever-changing circumstances, your behaviors, your attitudes. But true joy is a relationship. It's playing to an audience of one for satisfaction. Joy that thrives from the moment of our salvation to the moment of death cannot be found apart from Jesus Christ. People have tried since the dawn of time to find ways to make them happy. But it is nothing like the joy that's in Christ. It's why Paul could say to live is Christ. To die is gain. How could dying be gain? Except for the fact that you know the joy of the Lord. I believe, church, that joy can be defined as a positive confidence we possess by knowing and trusting God regardless of our circumstances or trouble. Joy is an inner delight while happiness is an outer illusion. Joy is relational, happiness is circumstantial. Jesus says that you will know when you have my joy because peace will follow it every single time. Every single time. You want to know why you don't have any joy? You want to know you don't have any peace? You don't have any Jesus. In ministry, I've discovered that there are some real joy jammers in people's life, things that just clog up the flow of joy. Selfishness is the first thing that blocks a life of joy. It's why the Bible is constantly telling us to look out for others, place the need of others ahead of us. The book of James says, wherever there is jealousy or selfish ambition, there will be disorder and every other kind of evil. The second is bitterness. Bitterness is a root-growing weed that chokes out joy. And most people cut off the symptoms but never kill the roots, and things like anger, rage, hatred, revenge, they just grow back. The book of Hebrews tells us to watch out that no bitterness takes root among you, for it springs up, causing deep trouble and wrecking many a spiritual life. Just this past week, a buddy of mine who's a pastor down at Vero sent me an actual obituary from their paper, and here's what it said. I hope nobody's related to this woman. So, Kathleen Dimlow was born March 19th, 1938, to Joseph and Gertrude Schunk of Wabasso. She married Dennis Dimlow at St. Anthony's in Wabasso in 1957 and had 2 children, Gina and Jay. In 1962, she became pregnant by her husband's brother, Lyle Dimlow, and moved to California, abandoning her children, Gina and Jay, who were then raised by her parents in Clements, Florida. She passed away on May 31st, 2018 in Springfield and will now face eternal judgment. She will not be missed by Gina and Jay, and they understand that this world is a better place without her. That is a boatload of bitterness, right? And some really bad therapy somewhere. Failed therapy, right? Think about how long you have to carry that around, right? That you spend money to spit on her memory in a community she doesn't even live in anymore, right? For real, how much joy do you suppose Gene and Jay have in their life? They have just walked around their entire life just going, you know? Really, bitterness kills you. Last is fear. Fear is the false evidence that appears real. Most of our fears are centered around unknowns of life that paralyze us. Fear keeps us from things like trust and being vulnerable and taking risks and living boldly. Fear causes us to build walls instead of bridges in our relationships. In fact, 1 John says, the man who lives in fear has not yet had his love perfected. Clearing the way for joy in our lives so that we can shine happens by giving and not getting, forgiving and not hurting, hurrying less, worrying less, and seeking God more. Honestly, and I know you expect me to say this because I'm the professional Christian, but literally I think Jesus is the center of all joy. Christian joy comes when we allow Jesus to live in our life, his vision, his mission through us, so that what he is what we become. So that what he is, we become. The Bible tells us that Jesus' joy is a complete joy. It's not an almost joy. It's not a sometimes joy. It's 100% joy. The uniqueness of this joy is captured in 1 Peter when he says, even though we've never seen or touched Jesus in the flesh, we believe in him. And because of this, we possess an inexpressible joy full of glory. In other words, you're supposed to shine. I think it was C.S. Lewis who once said that joy was the flag flown from the castle of your heart when the king was in residence. Isn't that a great line? How true is that? When joy seems absent, we should check and see who's sitting on the seat of that throne that was intended for Jesus. Church, the truth is life is fragile and it can turn suddenly. Have you ever noticed how easy it can go from the gladness of today to give way to the sadness of tomorrow? For the sweetness of the morning to turn to bitterness by night? Have you ever discovered that there are people in your life that you thought were friends who can literally abandon you and walk out of your life tomorrow? It just is amazing, isn't it? This is the world we live in. Listen, I know this full well. My office is a depository of brokenness and pain and hurt. And sometimes when people are really pissed off at God, I can become the target of their anger because they need an object of their wrath and rage, right? And things can get dark in my office. I see marriages crash at 90 miles an hour. I see people dismiss wisdom and go their own way. I watch betrayal disrupt community. I see lying, deflecting, and disobedience get rationalized. Listen, all of this stuff can suck the joy right out of you like a giant 12-pound leech attached to your brain. Sucking the joy right. Listen, if I did not have Jesus, I would be permanently cynical. It is Jesus that allows me to get up every morning and go, all right, I'm going to walk right back in to what some days is a cesspool of other people's brokenness. Joy allows that. Since our joy is in Jesus and Jesus never changes, the joy of Jesus in us never changes. Christian joy is about continuity and consistency of drinking living water every day. The Bible is God's handbook of joy. There are more than 400 references of joy and rejoicing in scriptures. You never have to go very far in the Bible to bump into joy and delight and celebration. I mean, even Paul tells us that we are to give cheerfully, right? That God doesn't want any of your grumpy money. Guy, if you've got to go, I don't want to give any, just keep it in your pockets. I mean, God's like, listen, our offering should be the most joyful time. It's why some people go, woo, you know, and do all that crazy stuff. It's living in anticipation of what God's going to do. I got to see what faithful giving brought last week, right? You don't know camp unless you go to camp. It's just amazing what giving made happen, right? Christian joy is about the person of Jesus Christ. Joy isn't an emotion that comes and goes. It's an attitude that comes and grows. I believe biblical joy shows up most often in community. It's what I love around here as we're trying to get worship started. There's a buzz in the room. There's some joy in the room. There's some happiness in the room. And I just want to yell, shut up, right? So, I mean, but that's Nathan's word, and I don't use that word. So there's an exchange of joy, a passing of the peace. There's a hope that we're in this thing together and not having to go it alone. Shared joy makes life twice as good and half as hard. A gloomy Christian is a contradiction in terms. Nothing in all of religious history has done more harm to Christianity than confusing reverence with somberness. Christian joy is contagious, it's viral, and we're intended to be epidemic. Here's the bottom line. Joy is the overflow of learning to love like Jesus. Contagious and comforting, our joy brings out the best in others. People love to see joy coming. The people in our church that are joyful, I love to see them coming down the hallway at me. Some of you, not so much. But those people coming at me, I mean, I'm just telling you, we have joyful people in our church. You'd love to see them. I saw one on the sidewalk as I was crossing from my office into this one. Huge honk and hug, man. It was awesome. It was just, he's full of joy. So let me share some things that fill my joy bucket beyond just communing with Jesus. I think it starts in Jesus. I never get tired of watching our youth worship. I just never get tired of that. I could sit in the back of youth camp and watch them worship all night long. In fact, the other night, they almost worshiped all night long. I never get tired of the unconditional love I feel at Cambridge when I go there. It's the only place in my life, literally, that it's 100% pure, unadulterated, as Sean was sharing, unconditional love. I never get tired of that. I never get tired of seeing children in our hallways running up and down, laughing, screaming, playing. I love to watch children who run up and down the aisles between the services. None of that troubles me. In fact, it brings a smile to my heart and face. I love watching ministries birth from community burdens that some of you feel, and they're downright inspiring. You just start ministries. You didn't need us to bless it. You didn't need us to fund it. You just made it happen. And here's the other thing. Knowing that while there are 153 million orphans in the world, it gives me joy to know that 20 of them are never going to have to know fear. That 20 of them are never going to have to worry about their life. I'm filled with joy every time we live by faith and not by sight. Every moment of redeeming love is a moment of joy for me. When something was dead that's now alive in Christ, this is a huge deposit of joy. So what's filling your joy bucket? What are you filling your joy bucket with? Let me close with this. Guys, y'all can come. Worship on Sundays is meant to be a celebration. This should be the dominant attitude of our heart, and it should be one of joy. Celebrating is a time to put aside the burdens and the trials of life and be together in laughter and in good times. It's moments of spurring one another on in love. It's genuinely, I genuinely think Sunday mornings ought to look like around here. We ought to be laughing together. We ought to be crying together. We ought to be celebrating God's presence in our lives. But somewhere in church history, this either gets lost or it gets misplaced, but somewhere someone decided that church was supposed to be somber and boring. Now, don't get me wrong. I think we ought to be reverent. But somber? Boring? Irrelevant? I just don't read that in the book anywhere. In Jesus' day, there was a group of people that sucked the joy right out of the church. They were called Pharisees. And they harnessed so many rules on the people, they just couldn't keep up. They just couldn't. They were joy stealers. They were the antithesis of simple church model that we employ here. The fact is that the world is full of people who don't understand your joy. They're jealous of your joy. They're resentful that you have it, and they don't. Their sole goal is to suck the joy out of you and to bring you down. There's a classic story in 2 Samuel. I'm going to just read excerpts from it. Let me set the stage for you. The Israelites have defeated the Philistines in a battle, and the Philistines are like their arch enemy, and it's just a big, huge win. And the Ark of the Covenant, which is the chest that symbolized all of God's promises to his people, you literally need to think Raiders of the Lost Ark, I mean, that's what you need to be thinking about, was being brought into Jerusalem on this particular day. It's a big honking deal. Again, think worship in the park, just like times 100, big step, people eating. And so here's what it says. It says this, David and all of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with castanets and harps and lyres and trembles and sistrums and cymbals and all kinds of musical instruments. And then it says, David wearing a linen ephod. All right? David is in his whitey-tighties, just so you understand that. David was dancing before the Lord with all his might while he and all Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and sounds of trumpets. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window, and when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent, and David had pitched for it, and David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. And after he finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person, the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. In other words, David funded the party to continue in their homes. He says, we don't want this to end, so we want you to go home and have this party. So when David returned to home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from the house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord, and I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in high honor. And it says that Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. She had no joy, is what some interpretations say. So when was the last time that you were so joyful you celebrated something by dancing around in your underwear? On second thought, don't think of that. Don't think of that. That's just, let that go. Here's what I would tell you. Every celebration, there is a party pooper somewhere. Michal misses the big picture. There's literally thousands of people sitting in pews today all over America who literally miss the big picture of worship. One great theologian, I think, said in a song, haters gonna hate. It's just what it is. Listen, literally, people would say that we laugh way too much in here. That the things we celebrate don't have a place in church. And I would ask, is God involved in some of our life or all of our life? Right? Joy is a natural expression of thanksgiving. We were dead, and now we're alive. We were crushed by our sin, and now we are redeemed. We once saw happiness, but now we are a people of joy. Listen, you just can't express too much joy. Richard Foster, who is the authority on spiritual discipline, said this, without a joyful spirit of festivity, all other disciplines become dull, death-breathing tools in the hands of modern Pharisees, right? Listen, I just want to tell you this morning, it's not that we don't know how to celebrate. We are a people that celebrate stuff all the time, grand moments of celebration. We have sports and parades and showers, and now we have reveal parties and weddings that are endless and over the top. We are a country that can turn the turning of a calendar page literally into the biggest party ever, right? And God could care less, but not us. We're a country, for crying out loud, that celebrates somebody else's Independence Day in May. I mean, we are a people that know how to party. I mean, let's, come on. But here's what I'm interested in. What are the things that touch off a celebration in heaven? What causes angels to sing? What causes God to smile? Is it being in here with each other, sharing life, laughing? Isn't that a foretaste of heaven? Isn't this supposed to be a foretaste of heaven? When Jesus says that we are to let it be on earth as it is in heaven, wasn't it the joy-infused hope would dominate our lives? Isn't this why that when Jesus was born, the angels came and said, listen, this is good news of great joy for all people when Jesus comes? Jesus, when I think what God has done for you and I think of one thing. It is party time. It is holy, reverent, it's party time. Party on. For what was lost has been found. And that we're committed to go and find lost people. You need to replace fleeting happiness with an eternal joy. Otherwise, I'm just going to tell you my experience. You're just going to be miserable all your life, and you're going to write a bad obituary about somebody. I mean, that's just what happens, right? Man, just trade it. Quit looking for happiness. Discover joy. And all of God's people said, amen.